Welcome back to the Prepared Mindset Podcast, guys. I'm your host, Austin, and this week we're gonna actually do something a little bit different. We're gonna carry on the discussion that we were able to have last week with Garrett Neal from RAS Group, and not in the specifics of what Garrett and I were able to get into, but what I think we really touched on in the last discussion, you guys, was a fundamental training mindset. And what I want to do this week is kind of build off that. It was interesting. I was having this conversation with my wife, talking about what we got into, talking about just different parts of the conversation. And if you guys haven't had the opportunity, definitely hit pause on this. Go back, check out the conversation I just had with Garrett. It was a really good one. But getting into beyond the basics, and not that everything that we talked about with Garrett was basics in orientation, but certainly we talked about the value, I think, of good fundamentals, good basic skill sets, a firm foundation, if you will, right, to build upon so that when you are looking to start pressing your limits, start pushing yourself beyond your comfort zones and things like that, you're able to do that without having to, I guess, put in. The easiest way I can explain this is if you build yourself up some good foundations and some good fundamentals, you will be more successful than if you don't and try to build off of a weak foundation. You'll be able to do it. You'll just put in five times the effort. One of the things I used to talk about when I was teaching high school musicians and things were, hey guys, if we write these parts for you, there's only two things that can be true. Either it really is too hard and it really is too difficult, or you've not put in enough time on it. And it was kind of a sobering experience for the kids when they had that discussion. We had it, you know, every year you always hit that point in the season where you have to come to the realization that, hey, either things have to change or you're not putting in enough effort. And more often than not, it was that the kids were not putting in enough effort. And I think with us as individual shooters, that's certainly something that we find ourselves faced with, right? So either the standard, which we're measuring ourselves against, is too great. It's too high at this point in time, or we're not putting in enough time and enough effort, right, to build those skills up. But what happens once we get past that point? At some point, right, we have to have achieved a certain level of mastery of the fundamentals. I'm not saying that we mastered them, you never go back to it, right? Because that's just not how it works. Some of the best shooters in the world have preached and do continue to preach the importance of these fundamentals. Certainly Garrett all the way on up to guys like, you know, Rob Epifania, who's a masterclass shooter and has been on the podcast a couple times, and a terrific, terrific individual and an amazing shooter, right? We have to be able to build past that. So we want to get into this week is talking about building an adaptive mindset, what that really, I think, could look like for you. And maybe it's not even just shooting, right? And perhaps it shouldn't just be shooting. I think that we build ourselves these mental barriers and we put up some walls for ourselves when we get into certain topics and certain disciplines of training, right? That there's just certain things we either don't need. There's certain levels that we can't exceed for ourselves because it's unreasonable. And sometimes it's an excuse. Sometimes it's truthful. I mean, do I think everybody needs to be able to reload as fast as Rob at like a 0.62 or whatever, pistol reload speed? No, I don't think you need to do that to be proficient, but certainly if it's something you want to do, there's a way to go about doing it. And when we're talking about general proficiency, right, there's a way to get more proficient in many, many different ways and regards. So we're going to get into that this week. But before I do, you guys, if this is your first time stopping in, thank you so much. We love having you guys, and I hope that this content, episodes like this one, are valuable to you. I think, you know, one of the things when I was getting started with this podcast was I used to look forward to some of the discussions, being able to share ideas and things. Even before when I was getting ready to start this, I would listen to certain podcasts out there and I would look forward to their releases because it was exciting that I had the opportunity week to week to learn something new, maybe from a different discipline, from a different walk of life. You know, the host was, I think, former Army. So if you had guys come on that were former Navy or former Marines, or even my favorites, a lot of the times were guys that were law enforcement, but non-conventional law enforcement, like John Norris, right? And he, you know, set up the Met team for marijuana interdiction out in California as a game warden. And I'm like, okay, cool. So this is different, and I get to learn about a piece of our community, right? That I usually don't get exposure to. So hopefully these episodes and these discussions and things that I'm bringing forward to you guys are of an exciting experience and a good value. I try to make sure that we bring forth as much information here as possible so that it brings something to you guys and you want to come back for more. Now, in terms of being able to bring that to you guys, our weekly content, you guys, there is a Patreon page. You guys can head on over to patreon.com/prepared_mindset_pod. That is a great way to support the mindset here if you guys are looking for a way to contribute. So there's longer form videos. There's stuff we can't necessarily post on Instagram or YouTube. There's blog posts, there's targets, there's drills, yes, videos, like I said. It's a great way to support us. And additionally, if you guys aren't down with Patreon, the paywall and things like that, I get it. But if you do want to find a way just to support us a little bit and get something back for yourself in return, if you head over to our Instagram page, we have our link tree. You can access that. And there's our Spreadshirt shop. So if you guys are looking to grab a t-shirt or a hat or a hoodie, even a coffee cup, a tote bag, any of that stuff, a little piece of those purchases come back and help support everything that we're doing here at Prepared Mindset to try and bring better quality content on our YouTube channel. If you guys are listening here, pause, go check out our YouTube, same name and same logo. Go ahead and hit subscribe on that because we're actually seeing some incredible growth in the last just 90 days. It's awesome to see. And it's a big, big focus this year to do more with that, bring more of the visual medium forward for you guys, our supporters. But in addition to all of that, we have some incredible sponsors that support this podcast that have been with us in many instances, multiple years. In some instances, it was when we were customers, and now as business partners. In other instances, they're mentors and friends of ours, and they're tremendously helpful in achieving the goals and things that we have for Prepared Mindset, especially as we roll through 2025. We're almost into March. It's unbelievable, you guys. But I want to say thank you to those partners because their support directly makes this possible week over week, and then with the sit rep episodes month over month. So first, I want to say thank you to Custom Night Vision, you guys. The website is customnightvision.com, and I recommend you go check it out because, you know, Custom Night Vision does a fantastic job. The pricing there, the availability there is top notch, and I hate to say it, you guys, but it's the truth. Night Vision is, it's not getting any cheaper. It just isn't. So if you guys are one of those people, you're on the fence, you want the capability, you're curious about it, or maybe you've experienced it, you borrowed a buddy set, and you know that you want to get into your very own set of either green phosphor or white phosphor, single tube, dual tube, maybe even you're somebody who's been saving up and you sold a boat and you got a bunch of cash burning a hole in your pocket, maybe they can hook you up with some quad tubes, head on over to customnightvision.com. They will take great care of you, you guys. There's a custom chat function that's built into the lower right-hand corner of the site, so you can actually reach out to the team, whether that's Ben or Kevin or Trevor, and ask them the questions that are burning in your brain about night vision and making sure that you have a positive and transparent purchasing experience. So you want to make sure that you're spending all this money, that you're getting a good tube, because the picture could be great, but you don't really know what you're looking for. Well, you can jump on the website. Again, it's customnightvision.com. You can contact the team. You can ask them if you're going to really suffer in your experience going, you know, with green phosphor over white because it's a little bit cheaper. Or, hey, what's the difference between Photonis and L3? Is that Gen 2 Plus with the, you know, the extra gain that Photonis has come out with, is that really going to compare to what I would experience with maybe a filmless L3 or a thin-filmed Elbit tube? What are the pros? What are the cons? What does FOM mean? What does signal-to-noise ratio? Like, what does that mean? How am I gonna make a decision here on one tube versus the next? They're there to support you guys, and they have all kinds of units in stock ready to go. So whether that's a PVS-14 or a Tonto or an RVM-14, any of those you know great monocular devices that are floating around out there, or dual tube housings like the RNVGA or the Manticore or the MH1. And if you guys don't know what those mean, hey, just ask them for the recommendation. They'll be able to give you some awesome pros and cons. Again, it's customnightvision.com. Heading over to the site, let them know that we sent you. They are going to hook you guys up. Also want to say thank you to the team at American Defense Manufacturing. You guys, the website there is admfg.com. And if you're looking for a top shelf, accurate, reliable, outstanding rifle, cannot recommend American Defense Manufacturing enough, you guys. They set out their Mod 2 upper to me with the core barrel in it. Very, very accurate. I've enjoyed shooting that thing. It's been a complete and total dream. Made out of top shelf components and parts like the Raptor charging handle from Radian, their proprietary M-Lock rail an awesome, awesome solution if you guys are looking for an upper receiver. And if you're looking for a complete rifle, they sell lower receivers, billet, so you guys get a great mate up. You get a great pairing there, upper to lower. It's going to be a dream to shoot. And they also make some outstanding mounts for your scopes, for your red dots, for your laser devices, and a whole heck of a lot more. Again, their website is admfg.com. Go check out the whole catalog of what they have to offer today. Want to say thank you now to our friends, the team, the entire cadre over at Orion Training Group, you guys. The website is oriontraininggroup.com. We're excited. They're actually going to be heading back up here to the Great White North, or when they get here, it won't be so white, but they're coming back up to Michigan in May and holding a two-day structure clearance fundamentals course. Very, very excited to have both Jason Ransom and Jared Arsenault back here in the Mitten State for another class. They were up here last year, had a handful of us go take that class together, and it was an outstanding learning experience, you guys. And that just goes on the list of classes we've been able to take from the Orion cadre, whether it's Blake and Alex at Maneuver Training Solutions, Joe Pistone, Jared, Jason, Lindsay Dew with LKD Communications, just a tremendous group of individuals there that are very passionate about teaching and wanting to bring their knowledge and share their experience and information and skill sets with all of you guys. Again, head on over to oriontraininggroup.com. You can check out the entire course list for yourself. Find a class near you. And if you can't find one, reach out. Maybe you can get one on the books for late this year or maybe even next year. You guys train ahead, plan ahead. And again, oriontraininggroup.com. And lastly here, thank you to 100 Concepts, you guys. 100concepts.com, that's the website. And if you're looking for their scope caps, their light caps, there's a ton of companies out there that sell them, that stock them, because they're outstanding solutions. But if you want some, if you need to use their custom tool they have built into the site to make sure you get the right fit for your scope, the right size for your flashlight, head on over to 100concepts.com. Accept no substitutions, you guys. It is crazy. Now, after 100 kind of hit the home run with their scope caps and now their hex cap series for red dots, the pro cap series for scopes that builds in the anti-reflective device with the protective cap, it is crazy how many imitators you see floating around out there on the internet. There is only one 100 Concepts, though, you guys. Great company and some fantastic humans there running the show. The company motto is do good, be dangerous, live free. Highly encourage you guys check out the website. Go pick up some Scrim, their chem light kit. If you're out there doing night vision stuff, maybe you pick up a set of tubes from Custom Night Vision. You can head on over to 100concepts.com, pick up their chem light kit, pick up some Scrim for yourself. So when you're out in the woods doing stuff with the boys, getting some training done, you are well prepared and well camouflaged. I can't thank those guys enough for their support. Our longest sponsor and some very, very good friends of ours. But yeah, you guys, so this week, we're going to get into building an adaptive mindset is really the way I'm thinking about this and looking beyond training basics. So last week when we had Garrett on, we talked about strong fundamentals, right? And having those good on the flat range fundamentals is key to being successful in whatever avenue of training you pursue. So if you're somebody who really just wants to be a really good competitive shooter, you have to have strong fundamentals, because once you start having to run around and memorize layouts and round counts and shooting, you know, through and around barricades, things like that, none of that stuff is possible without a solid base and fundamental skill in both the shooting piece, obviously, but then the movement piece too, is something that people don't really take into account. And there are people that specialize in teaching that and training that kind of thing. The movement is huge. CQB, for example, I think is a lot more about the movement and understanding of movement and angles and reading rooms and reading threats than it is about shooting, because the distances tend to be so close that even decent shooters are able to be very effective and very capable. That's not to take anything away from people that have exceptional marksmanship skills. It's just the way CQB distances work, reflexive shooting, and the studies and the work and everything that has gone into that show that you can kind of hide some of your accuracy. Hostage situations notwithstanding, obviously, because your distances of engagement are so close. But how do we train really, right, when we get away from just running drills in the flat range? How do we train not just for, you know, the things that we have in our mind when we're running those drills. So draw from concealment. I mean, it's draw from a duty holster, right? Where you have this scenario built up in your mind where if you're in law enforcement, you're, you know, on a roadside stop and you're kind of staring this guy down and who's going to draw faster type thing. Or maybe in the military, you have a, you know, this preconceived idea of what your very first gunfighter engagement is going to look like. I don't know, right? But how do we train for the unexpected? Meaning, how are we not necessarily going to dream up more complicated, more ridiculous situations in our brain, right? And certainly you could do that. You can try and you can whiteboard the shit out of it, right? You can what if this thing to death, quite literally. I mean, I know there are guys that are going to sit there and their brain functions that way. So they'll whiteboard this down. They'll say, well, here's one situation, here's this other situation, or they'll keep a journal when they listen to podcasts like this, right? When we have guests on or other podcasts, certainly when people tell stories about engagements they have, times that they've been shot at or had to shoot somebody, had to deploy their firearm, things like that, right? And they'll gather all of these stories and all this data and all this information, and they'll use it as a justification for how they build training, right? And there's not, and that's not to say that that's wrong. Like, I'm not saying that is a bad idea. But what I am saying is, if we want to sit here and do that, right, A, it's going to take a lot of time, and it is going to be absolutely and completely, okay, exhausting to try and sit there and pick apart everybody's story across multiple means, multiple medias, right? So video podcasts, regular podcasts, discussions you have in real life with friends or family or acquaintances that might be in law enforcement or former military, or perhaps they're one of those unlucky souls that had to actually deploy their firearm in a life or death situation as a lawfully armed civilian. It's exhausting. So how do we, for shooting, and like I said earlier, for shooting and other skill sets that apply to real world situations, right? How do we train ourselves to be effective, be ready, so that when something happens, and I think that it's important to look at it with the lens of when, not if, because once we start looking at a lot of this discussion and say, well, if that ever happens, and, you know, because I feel like that's the first step down the path of getting to some of these, how can I phrase this? This like fuddy-duddy mindset. I sound like my mother, fuddy-duddy. One of these like FUD mindsets of thing, you know, oh, well, if that ever happens, and it's such a big if, so do I really need 15 plus one and a Glock 19 for a carry gun? No, I could get away with something smaller like a, you know, like a shield or something where I can carry, you know, maybe 7 rounds plus one, right? So 8 rounds would be more than enough for me, right? Or then I can go ahead and, oh, I can carry less than that. I can get away with a Glock 43 where it's 6 plus 1, so it's even less, right? Or then I can go ahead and I can get away with a wheel gun, right? So a little 5-shot 357 revolver is going to be enough to where I can go ahead and, you know, that's all I need. I don't need to carry it in my waistband because that's uncomfortable because it's really unrealistic, so an ankle holster will be fine. And you know what I mean? Like, we just get to this, point where we mentally, right, paint ourselves in such a mental box that we are not able to get out of it, and we actually remove ourselves from the opportunity to train and build proficiency by false justification, right? Like, we what if it in the opposite direction, and before you know it, you're not even taking the gun with you when you leave the house. You're finding reasons to, oh, well, you know, I'll be at a crowded shopping mall. There's no way anything would happen there, and there'll be a ton of people, you know, and there's no way I'll need it, or I wouldn't be able to be effective anyway because the crowd's too thick. You know what I mean? Like, we will find a way to justify a greater lack of preparation going that route. So I think, how do we train ourselves from kind of going from, I guess, this fixed mindset of what we do on the flat range to being more adaptive? Because when we talk about training on the flat range, a lot of people talk about training scars, right? They go straight to this idea of, you know, oh, you'll build scars if you don't change up what you're training. And that's true to an extent, certainly, but anything is. Like, let's be clear on that. I think that, excuse me, I think that any amount of focused training can be can be a bad thing if you overdo it or if you are hyper-focused on one skill set. And it's actually interesting. We mentioned Jason Ransom, one of the Orion Training Group cadre members, just a moment ago during the ad space. And this morning, actually, Jason sent me a video. I believe it was a basketball coach. It was a female. She was wearing a Pacers zip-up, so I don't know if she's actually a coach for the Pacers, which is, if you guys don't know, the Indiana Pacers are a professional NBA basketball team. But what she was speaking on was block practice or block training, where you'll spend 3 hours working on one specific skill set, right, with a coach or something, or we'll do it on the flat range, certainly. At the end of that 3 hours, if you're just practicing one reload once, right, or your draw from concealment and one round on target, so a Tueller drill. So drawing from concealment, presenting that firearm, shot to the A zone in under 1.5 seconds. That's the Tueller drill, because the logic and rationale behind that is that an assailant can close, I think it's 15 feet. They can close 15 feet in 1.5 seconds. So the logic and rationale there being that if you can deploy that firearm effectively in under 1.5 seconds, that you will be able to protect yourself and be more efficient and capable. And certainly, I appreciate the logical approach to that, where, you know, hey, this makes sense. Like if I would assume most people would look at 15 feet and say that's out of arm's reach, that's a safe and reasonable distance. But is it really, when you look at the data behind how quickly somebody can close, you know, that gap? So then we spend our time just working on that draw in one shot, or the one reload one, or a one transition one, if we're talking about a carbine and a handgun, right? But we'll spend 3 hours working on just one of those. And then we'll take another 3 hours and we'll work on just that. And another 3 hours of working on just that. And at the end of those time blocks, we may be better at any of those things. But then if we are put into a situation where we have to, this basketball coach was saying, if you mix it up, like batting practice for a baseball team specifically, where, you know, you go ahead and they give you, you know, curveballs for 3 hours. You're way better at hitting a curveball, you know, fastballs, right? But if they mix it up, so you have curveball, fastball, slider, fastball, fastball, curveball, fastball, slider, you know, where it's random, right? And you as a individual, maybe you don't see as much individual progress. You don't see as much development and growth from that 3 hour session of randomized training that you would if out of a focused training block. But the evidence typically is that the people that do the randomized training are better because their vision's better and their thought process is better, and they're able to process more quickly and react more efficiently and more accurately. And that's in sports, right? So, but the processing piece, we talked about this, you know, with Garrett last week, was processing is a very underrated portion of what we talk about in so many of these topics and so many of these skill sets, is the ability to mentally process data, whether that's target data, whether that's situational, whether that's the physical data that we're given from a reticle and a scope, or the feel of a trigger break and things like that. That's all data that our brain can then process, and we can use that as individuals and as shooters, right, to improve, to adjust. So like a miss and a makeup on the range, right? But there's dangers behind static training. The fixed mindset of only practicing one thing can be pretty rough. Solely relying on these range drills, like an individual drill or two, right, for a range session, or, you know, excuse me, only doing flat range drills leaves obviously a lot of, it can leave a lot of gaps in your training. I think a lot of people believe that if you're proficient in a handful of drills that you see popularized on social media, that you're well prepared. So, yep, I got the Tueller drill down pat. Like we're talking concealment, draw one round at, you know, 15 feet, and I'm doing that pretty solidly at 1.15 or 1.20. I'm doing good. Repetitive. I can, you know, do it on command. I'm doing good, and I can do a pistol reload in about, you know, a second or so. Like I got all this stuff, but it's all static. It's on the range. We're not really talking about movement. We're not talking about multiple responsibilities or threats or anything like that. But because you have those strong fundamental pieces and those basics, it's a false confidence that I think that in a lot of cases we are very good at building up for ourselves. And pushing past that and putting ourselves in an uncomfortable situation with more randomized responsibilities and tasks, I think is a more effective way of measuring and building certainly the skill sets that we're trying to develop for ourselves. So, expanding beyond that tunnel vision. So, hey, do you have an opportunity? And this is, you know, maybe we just operate under the pretense of you only have a flat range to train on and you don't have training partners with you. Let's say that, right? So, because that's what a lot of us run into is, hey, I do have a flat range where I can do a lot of these things, but I don't have people out here to help me. I don't have role players and access to sim rounds and stuff. Like, okay, so maybe what you can do to work on your situational awareness and things is, you can set up multiple targets, some shoot, some no shoot, right? And work a course of fire or a string of fire, whatever. I mean, I don't know what people call it. And you work on discerning and identifying whether it's a shoot or no shoot, a friendly or a threat, and getting away from that tunnel vision of just staying front sight focused, just staying target focused, and giving yourself more things to have to kind of spend some mental calories on, because it's really easy. And I saw this, I've seen this on the range where it's like, all right, we're gonna do a ready up drill, you know, we're going to do a standards drill here. On the beep, you're going to go from your low ready with your carbine and you're going to snap that round off. As soon as you hear that beep, you're going to snap that dot up to the center of the target, break the safety, and then pull the trigger, bang, you should have that one shot at 7 yards or 10 yards or 15, whatever. And you will absolutely see guys that will, I mean, and you should pre-stage, right, with your thumb on the safety, still on safe, but on the safety, and your finger kind of just outside the trigger well. So as the gun comes up, right, you're going to disengage the safety with your thumb as your index finger, so kind of like that pinching motion, comes down to the trigger. And as soon as you see the flash of red over that A zone, you're going to break that shot, right? But we know, guys, that when we get out on the range, right, you know there's dudes out there. They're just there to stroke their ego and just pad their confidence. They're going to break a shot at 7 yards as fast as they fucking can, and they're going to throw it. And they don't care. And what I mean by throwing it is they're literally going to start that process I just explained, where you turn off the safety and start applying that consistent gentle pressure to the trigger, right? They're going to start that as soon as they hear that beep and the timer go off, and they are not going to wait for that little red blur to get over that A zone. They're worried about a time, and that's it. They're worried about being able to do the action within the time, but they're not worried about the outcome, because as long as they get close or they're at such a short distance that it doesn't matter, they're not going to really challenge themselves. They're going to sit there. They're going to get to that point. They're going to reaffirm themselves every time they come to the range. Yep, I still got it. Repeatability, man. I'm locked in. Game time, game fit. Like, I am ready, coach. Like, you know, shit pops off. I'm shit hot. I'm ready to fucking go. And guys will actually think that makes them a prepared individual because of what they're able to do on the range without any additional factors. So certainly, you find a way to get away from that tunnel vision. If you are able to, bringing somebody out onto the range with you to, you know, randomize the targets for you is one way to do it. One that always is interesting to me that comes back to an old video that I think was called the Aimbot video that Lucas Bodkin from T-Rex Arms did. And what he had was, I want to say it was 5 or 6 targets, and they had numbers spray painted on them. So they had like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on the A zones, but then they also had, I think it was like 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 spray painted on the head boxes of these targets. And he had somebody with him. He would turn around, so his back was to the targets, and they would give him like a string of fire. So, you know, 10, 1, 7 or something, right? And then on the beep, he'd turn around, and if it was an A zone, it was 2 rounds. And if it was a head box, it was 1 round. And, you know, so, you know, 10, 1, 7, then beep, he turns around, finds 10, 2 rounds, 1 round of the head box, 1 is 2 rounds to the body, and 7 was a head, so 4 rounds total, right? So you have that processing, you have to get out of that tunnel vision, because now you have to start scanning to find a target, and you have to, you're pushing for the best time that you can. And it's a way of adding some, I don't want to say it's stress inoculation to your training, but it's adding additional layers to your training. So things like putting, if you have any kind of time standard that you can put to yourself, Because some guys are, they don't even use time standards on the range. And you guys are going to say, no, that's not true. Like, you just talked for all this time about time standards and everything. There's no way. And I'm going to tell you, yes, there is a way. Because I've been on the range with guys that don't use timers to grade themselves. They don't use some kind of a standard or a par time or time hack. I think this, all that stuff means the same thing. It's do this drill and under this time. All of those terms, all those labels mean the exact same thing. But I've been on the range with guys that don't do that. They don't utilize a shot timer for their training. They don't have a standard or a hack that they will place against a drill. And not all of them have to. I understand that. But if you're not using a time restraint on the drill as your added level of stress, then you should add some other level of stress. So maybe that's physical exertion. So if you're doing a lot of physical movement, and you know, so you're running forward and two shots on the first target, and then run to the right and two shots on that target, and then turn left and run, you know, over to the far left, and then put two rounds on that target, then back to the center in two rounds, and then run back to your point of origin, turn around, and then, you know, two precision shots. So I don't know, what is that, like 12 rounds or something, like 10 rounds, and that's your whole drill. And you're not trying to meet a 10-second time hack or something. You're trying to just be as accountable as possible, and then maybe your recorded time is 17 seconds or 27 seconds or 47 seconds. I don't know. But you now have additional stress introduced because you are shooting and moving, and you can start working some of these adaptive skills. Like one of the things that I saw on that particular range day with those guys not using a timer, that's fine. It was new to me, because a lot of the training I had done with Josh was, hey, ready up drills, measuring ourselves against the timer. How fast and efficiently can we do this? Hey, run this drill. Here's your time. One of the things I noticed was, hey, you can start, you know, reaching for your emergency magazine, right? Your reload. You can start that process sooner. You can move both hands at once versus one and then the other, right? Like little things. And then we're going to run it again, and we're going to try and get it under this time standard. Whereas with this, it's less about those administrative skills, and it's about things that really only come into play when you're trying to be more adaptive. So, hey, when you're running from point A to point B to point C to point D, as you're coming into those different positions that you're shooting from on this T drill or whatever, as you're getting there, you can start pressing out towards the target with your handgun and start putting yourself into that shooting position before you've come to a complete stop. Because what you would see is guys would, they'd start running, they'd go full tilt to that first spot, and they would wait till they get there, and they'd square their feet up, and you'd see them. They stop, then they square their feet, then they get their rifle and bring it up to the firing position, and then you see them break the two rounds, go back on safe, and then they start moving. And in reality, what you can do to help save time if you're trying to be as proficient and efficient as is possible is you can actually go ahead, you can start building that shooting platform, bringing your hands up with your handgun or with your rifle as you're getting to that position. As you're getting there, you can start, you know, because none of us, we usually don't run with our feet apart. At least not shoulder width apart like you would when you're firing. Now, I mean, maybe sometimes we do if you crap your pants and you're trying to, you know, make it in the house before your neighbors notice or something, or, I mean, whatever, right? There's exceptions to everything. Maybe you chafed really bad. I've certainly had, one of the years I did indoor drumline, guys, they made our costumes for that year out of pleather. So pleather pants in 86 degree weather on blacktop. I chafed worse than I think I ever have had at any point in my life. And if that makes you guys laugh, I'm glad that my pain can bring you some happiness, because it was the most uncomfortable day of my life, I think. But these we don't usually run bow-legged like that. You know what I'm saying? at least I hope not. But what we're talking about, this, as you're getting closer to that to the X, right? Or that shooting position, whatever. I mean, the X is kind of cringy. I don't think we really call it the X anymore. But this dynamic movement as we're going from one shooting position to the next shooting position to the next shooting position is, you can start widening those last three or four steps. You can start gradually widening your stance with each step, so that as you finally do come to that stop, you're in that staggered foot position, that fighter's stance, ready to lean into that gun. You're already mounted with the gun in your shoulder pocket, or if it's a handgun, right, you're already coming into that position, building out your frame to break that shot, right? You're picking up your sights on that last step or two, maybe on that very last step, your muzzle's already up presented towards the target. So you're working on breaking that trigger. Breaking off that safety, turning off the safety before you even come to that full stop. So that when you do finally stop and you have that instant the instant of rest where it's like just there on like the edge of the cliff before you're about to go over and you can break that shot on target, right? I think that kind of dynamic movement, you don't need to complete a drill in 20 seconds or less. You can if you want to add that kind of additional layer, but certainly that's something that I think a lot of guys miss on, because while I've never been in a gunfight, I can tell you that dudes that have, as well as guys who are competitive shooters, will 10 out of 10 times tell you that the movement component is one of the more critical pieces of the entire equation. And guys, look around online. I mean, we're facing a community-wide issue with fitness. It's gotten a lot better. It gets a lot more attention than it used to. But there's reasons why we talk about and preach physical capability and personal health so much. And it's not just because everybody likes to, maybe some of you guys do, not judging. Some of you guys do like to check out pictures of other guys who are in really, really good shape. And that's what you enjoy about the community. And cool, I guess, if that's what you're into. But the reason that health consciousness is such a big deal in the community is because the lack of health, the lack of physical ability, it has a direct correlation to your individual capability. So if you can't run, if you can't move quickly and efficiently, you are going to be less efficient in a gunfight. And again, I don't want to build the scope of this entire conversation around gunfighting, because I can't speak firsthand on it. Now I've run some of those drills. So in the context of that performance metric and that dynamic movement piece, yes, I can speak to that because I've done it, but it's a huge part of it, right? And then we talk about things like bugging out and rucking and things. And if you can't physically carry the load of the kit and the gear that you have, it doesn't matter what you have and what you don't have. The gear makes absolutely no difference at all if you physically are unable to carry out the tasks which that gear is in support of. So if you can't carry that 60-pound ruck, it doesn't matter how much food and water you have in there. It doesn't matter how much, observation equipment. It doesn't matter how good of a shot you are at 800 yards with the 20-inch or 18-inch gas gun in, 6 arc or 6.5 Creedmoor that you have, or 308, right? That doesn't matter, because you won't make it to your objective point to utilize those tools, because physically you're not in a position to be able to apply them. So the dynamic movement piece and movement in general tied to physical health is a huge part of it. And that's training off the range, guys. Like, people look at the gym and going to the range like they're completely unrelated, and they really aren't. You will start to notice that you are able to get off the X a little bit quicker. That drop in motion and that step to like kind of load up and run from point A to point B during your drill, you'll find that that gets better. You'll find that your grip is stronger and easier when you build up, your upper body and your arms. And I know technique will fix a lot of this stuff, but there's a reason why guys who are decent shooters, heavy or even great shooters, there's a certain amount of muscle mass that exists on their body. They're not all like, just complete twigs. Now, I'm not saying you have to be, like the fucking Swede from... what is that movie with Clint Eastwood? Oh, it's not Hamburger Hill. I know that. It's Heartbreak Ridge. That's what it is. Heartbreak Ridge, Mario Van Peebles. You don't have to be built like a brick shit house, but certainly having muscle mass on you to help lean into the gun to fight recoil, to apply pressure, that vice grip pressure on your handgun for accuracy and recoil control, all that stuff, right? That is all a huge part of all of this shit. Like, it all plays together. And further, we're still just talking about movement. If you take all of that now and you shift your scope to, let's be more adaptive. Let's change not just the situation in which we have to shoot, but maybe it's the time of day, the environment, right? So imperfect conditions. So training in low light, and that's a tough one. I'll say that pushing those things into a white light situation where everything we just talked about is now amplified in its difficulty, because we're responsible for every single round that we put down range. And yes, that's a little bit different with qualified immunity for law enforcement and military, but it, versus you know, the conversation of a civilian, an armed civilian carrying a firearm who may shoot someone, right? Different conversation. However, it is something that you need to be cognizant of and look for the opportunities to apply that stuff. At the very least, it should be built into your own dry fire practice, because working that, like, and ask somebody who's learning to shoot to come dry fire with you and see what they're working on, and then have them work in white light skills. And they're probably going to have some struggles with it. I know I can say this very confidently because my own brother messaged me about it just a couple of weeks ago. He goes, man, F this whole white light thing. And, you know, I had to like chuckle to myself because I know exactly what he's going through. It's that you have focused so intently on what we started talking about here, right? Which is, I have this 5 or 6 drill plan, and I work through this plan every time I dry fire, every time I go to the range. So holster draw and presentation, maybe a holster draw and a build drill, right? And then maybe one reload one, or one transition one, or one reload one, you know, pistol and carp, right? Whatever it is for you. I mean, you know, it's an L pres, but you have that whole process, right? And you work on that every time. And whether you intend to or not, you build that training scar of you're really good at those 6 things and only those 6 things. And then you could take those exact same 6 things, and now you have to apply white light fundamentals to it, and it is not the same. It is a totally different proposition, because while before you were quite quick at drawing the pistol or presenting the carbine, getting that sight picture and breaking the trigger, now your sight confirmation, that split moment where you are seeing your dot of your optic, or maybe it's the alignment of your iron sights, if you're an old school individual, no hate. You know, much respect for the iron sight crowd out there, but now part of your sight picture and your target confirmation is that you also have to activate the white light, which may be easier for a carbine, right? Because a lot of cases it's just a push button or a pressure pad on top of the rail for a lot of us. I'm a big fan of pressure pads because it's just a squeeze, right? My hand usually rests pretty close to that pad, and it's a very, very small adjustment. But then you have that additional aspect of processing comes back to it. So now you have to present the gun, turn the white light on, and you have to process what you're seeing with both your optic and your eyes, identify the target, is my dot overlaid on the target, and then you get back to, you jump back onto the track of breaking that trigger with an accurate shot. And it is absolutely surprising to so many people that when they finally try this shit, where they add the white light component into it, which, I mean, a lot of people will and have sat here and go, hey, it's just adding a flashlight to what I've already been doing, right? What's the big deal? It's not that hard. Just go ahead and, you know, you're just illuminating the area, and it's different. And further, when we're talking about that, your environment has, under low light conditions, has even more to say about it, because then you have things like photonic barriers. So does your light have the power to punch through the street light that's in front of you that could be impairing your vision, right? Or maybe you're in a house and all of the walls are white. And if you guys don't know about how, you know, white lights work with white walls, it can actually reflect that white light back at you and make your life more difficult. And you're not going to understand those difficulties until you get into actually training that, where, hey, maybe I don't blast this white light out directly at the target, and, you know, at least not initially, right? That's, for a lot of people, this is why they are proponents of a handheld white light and a handgun, because then you can illuminate the baseboards and you can get enough illumination in your workspace or your AO, or I don't know, whatever term or label you want to put on it, right? And you can actually see the target without having all that white light flashed back at you by the reflection of the paint and things like that. And then if you need to bring the light up or bring the gun up, then you can obviously work that way. And to an extent, you can go with a carbine too. Maybe it's one of the disadvantages that exists there. But I mean, here nor there, you guys are understanding that this all of a sudden becomes a much different proposition when you start working in white light. And having to make that those decision-making skills, having to have those available, right? Having to make that decision to pull the trigger, and everything's elevated at night too, because you can't see. So I feel like people are more jumpy, right? Because it's easier to scare people. I mean, think about when you're a kid, right? You hide around the corner, your friend walks by, you jump out and, you know, boo, and you freak them the hell out. And they, you know, what the fuck is wrong with you and all that shit, right? Or maybe you still do it. I do it to my wife and it's great. Like, we all love it. But in terms of a life or death engagement with a firearm, if you react to a stimulus like that, and it's completely reactionary, and you jerk that trigger, you're still accountable for that round that goes downrange. It is still on you with what happens. So if you shoot the wrong person, if it's your kid coming home in the middle of the night or something, and you thought it was somebody breaking into the house, and you accidentally shoot them, you are still, accident or not, 110% liable for whatever the fuck just happened. And too many people don't build this kind of stuff into their training. And taking this a step further, it's when we put ourselves in this kind of, I don't want to say situationally dependent or situation or environmentally driven training necessarily, but your gear, like we don't test for things like this. We don't understand, like I was talking about a moment ago with a handheld versus a weapon-mounted light. Again, one of the things people teach white light classes really, really harp on, and this is not just because they're being high and mighty or extra preachy, is that people will put a white light on their gun and say that they carry a flashlight. And the problem with that fundamentally is that now anything you're looking to illuminate is being muzzled by your firearm, which breaks one of the foundational, fundamental safety principles of carrying a firearm. Is you don't point the gun at anything that you are willing to destroy. So if that's your wife coming home late, your kid breaking back into the house when they snuck out past curfew, or the neighbor kid coming to return a toy or something that they borrowed and forgot about. I mean, it could be anything, right? But understanding the limitations of your gear, your handheld light, your weapon light, the positioning of the pressure pad on your rifle, the sling on your rifle. If you go to present that gun and it gets caught on something on your kit, like a plate carrier or something, I had that issue. I actually had to, I wound up ordering a whole new rifle mag pouch for my FCPC because the thin cummerbunds that they have are basically three row, and the pouch I bought from Blue Force Gear was a five row Molly setup. And the issue was that enough of it was hanging down off of the cummerbund that my sling would slip underneath it. So when I would go to bring that gun up during training, it would actually snag on that mag pouch, and I would have to take that extra second to either unhook it or swim my arm through the sling. And when I would do that, it would unhook it, and I would then have to do that. I would rebuild and reposition myself, rebuild my structure on the carbine behind the gun, and I'm adding time, which under a drill just means that, yeah, you may not meet the time standard. But in realistic applications, what we're saying is you're adding a second or 2 seconds or longer, because remember, if you aren't training on a regular basis with your gear, you're not going to know, oh, hey, I got hung up on that pouch again, or hey, there's a snag here. You're going to have to start looking, and you're diagnosing your processing time of what's wrong is going to be much larger. So you're putting yourself and your OODA loop and everything much behind the curve of what's going on in that situation. You're basically setting yourself up for failure by not knowing your kit. And a lot of this stuff, guys, this isn't new shit, right? Like, we've talked about this before, and there's a ton of video. It's not even just us. There's so many people out there on the internet that preach about this. You know, I don't want to say it's the, you know, quote unquote, train like you fight bullshit, because that gets played out really, really fucking badly and is really annoying within the community. I'll be the first one to admit that shit. But there is a lot of value to training in your kit, and why if you go to an outdoor range, go wear your fucking plate carrier. If it's something you do for work, wear your carrier, wear your belt. Don't just train slicked down, because when you go to mount that rifle and figure out that your plate carrier shoulder strap is shitty and it impedes your ability to get a good strong foundation with your shoulder pocket and things like that, you're not able to build the connection to your carbine the way that you normally would, that's a problem. And you don't want to discover that problem in a life or death situation when your skills and your presentment and your response time and accuracy and everything your life depends on all of that. That's the last and worst time you should want to be making those personal discoveries. I mean, And that's on top of shit happening. Like your carrier breaks, your sling rips, your gun jams, whatever the fuck the case is. You know, you already have all of that to contend with. You don't need to give yourself any more, you know, problems to deal with, right? And I would just ask, you know, we're talking about these things. When's the last time you guys have worked on some of that stuff? You know, I'll be honest. I need to spend more time with my white light dry fire. I've done it. I know how to do it, but I definitely am behind the curve right now with white light presentment on firearms and the drills. So practical drills that we apply, you know, hey, so draw the pistol, present one round, or a bill drill, any of that stuff, right? Or same thing with the carbine, any of that stuff with a white light. I'm behind the power curve on that. When's the last time you guys worked on that? And that's not to like, hey, shit, you know, fuck you guys for not doing what you should do. We all have those shortfalls. It's why that this whole endeavor, this whole training journey and mission and desire to be more capable and more proficient, right? It's not a A to B concept. It's like an A to infinity concept because it never stops. Because as we get better at things, we have to maintain that proficiency while also then trying to build other skills. And there's so much stuff going on. None of us have the ability, I think, in regular life to just only worry about this shit. If you do, you're like a 20-something year old with a job and you live at home and you have no bills and this is your entire life, which isn't realistic for, I mean, anyone but that like 3% of the population that fits those very, very specific demographics. But, you know, it's not unreasonable to sit down and audit yourself that way and say, hey, when's the last time I practiced shooting offhanded, you know, which we did at a training session in November, I think it was here. And it was really illuminating to a lot of guys to see like, hey, I can't even fucking hit this B8 target with my left hand. Because we did 15 yards. I think left-handed was 10 yards. At 10 yards, there were guys that were completely not missing the center. They were completely missing the target with their left hand because they'd never worked on it. And they sit there, and like we talked about at the very beginning here, they found ways to justify to themselves that they would never need that. They would never need to employ offhand handgun shooting, you know, and maybe you won't. I mean, if you look at the numbers, statistically speaking, as much as I love and hate that concept, statistically, you may never end up in a fight for your life where you have to deploy your handgun with only your weak hand, but you could. This is why I used to, I do enjoy so much the content that Centrifuge puts out with Will Petty. We're talking about injured shooter considerations around a vehicle. So I think it was Practically Tactical was the YouTube channel. I don't even know if they are still around, honestly. But I have gone back and found those Will Petty videos because the way he talks through being able to pin the carbine in the wheel well or on the tire or making a porthole to like pin the rifle so that you can use a single hand, whether that's your primary hand or your support hand to work a charging handle. And it's honestly the video that convinced me, hey, I need an ambidextrous charging handle on my rifle because in the event that I only have my right hand available on a standard mil-spec charging handle, it is really, really difficult in an injured shooter drill to rack that charging handle with just your right hand. There's ways to do it. Will's video goes over that, but it's a lot of these what-if scenarios that people will justify their way out of. But realistically, especially if you're in law enforcement, and that's one of the things I really liked about Will is that he built a lot of his curriculum, if not all of it, around law enforcement statistics, specifically for those instances where, hey, you're probably not likely, but it's more likely than you think to end up in those scenarios. And here's the data to support that, and here's how you work through it. For me, that stuff's like brain candy, and I really geek out about some of that stuff. I wish I had more opportunity here in Michigan to take advantage of that kind of training, you know, shooting around a vehicle, injured shooter drills and stuff like that. And it's something I'd really love the opportunity to put myself through. But in terms of adaptive training and how we're going to modify what we work on with ourselves, I think stuff like that is absolutely what we should be looking at. You know, ask yourself those questions. When's the last time you practiced offhand? What's your contingency if your primary carry gun malfunctions? Like if your gun goes down, do you know your emergency malfunction clearance methods and things? Like do you strip the mag, rack the slide, reload? Do you not do it with a carbine, right? It's just, it's those kinds of questions that occasionally, you don't have to be, you know, shouldn't put yourself through this, you know, every month necessarily, but maybe once a quarter or twice a year, something like that. Hey, when's the last time I've looked at this? With all the training I'm doing month to month or week to week or whatever the case may be, because everyone's training cadence is obviously different. When is the last time that I looked at some of this stuff? When's the last time I realistically put myself to the test? And then I would also challenge you to take a look at that beyond the range. So mentally, are you in a good place where you're able to, you know, react and respond? Again, this processing piece speaks so much to where we're at mentally with our capability, not just what we can do in terms of pulling a trigger. So mentally, you know, crisis management, how does your mindset shift and impact or potentially impact your survival? I've struggled with that. I'll be honest with you. Like, I am one of those people, like, I'm very list oriented. I'm very target and goal oriented with how I do stuff in life. So whether that's, I mean, it can be anything like trips to the grocery store or travel trips with my wife and everything. Like, I like to have an idea heading into it, what that's going to look like and what that experience, what that might be like. And when plans go off the rails, and it doesn't have to be for a bad reason, it can just be, hey, like, your flight got delayed, you're not going to miss anything, but you're delayed, or, you know, whatever the case may be, that's something that I have to work on with myself to, like, calm down. All right, is this going to impact anything else? What are we going to do to make up the time difference? Or, you know, are we going to miss anything? Do we need to let anybody know? That kind of thing, let alone when it's in a situation where, you could have life threatening implications or ramifications. So like we saw years ago with the Summer of Love, with these quote unquote mostly peaceful protests that were moving through all of our cities, right? They were blocking freeways and pulling people out of cars and giving them a beat down, right? And burning down buildings in some states, like in Minnesota, right? If that kind of thing were to happen, would you be somebody who closes down, shuts down, and panics? Or do you have the mental wherewithal to calm yourself and process and think your way through what you would do? Because in that situation, it's not going to be, you know, pull out your gun and start blasting, right? Like the meme of Frank, right? So anyways, I started blasting. No, you're going to have the mental wherewithal to, okay, let me go get my radio and turn it to the emergency channel out there. And let's see if there's any, you know, hams jumping around that are sharing that emergency information, as they sometimes do, which even understanding and having that knowledge there is a step beyond what many people, have or would think to do. But, you know, hey, let me think about that. Let me hear where the danger areas are. Is my area directly, you know, impacted or affected? Maybe I reach out to my local network of people that live in the surrounding area. Hey, what have you guys heard? Maybe you have an emergency group chat set up or a Discord or a Signal chat or something where you can start gathering some of that intelligence and you can start disseminating that and processing your way through that to understand what is your next step. How am I going to, if I need to leave my home, you know, is bugging out really the realistic best option? A lot of people like to romanticize the concept of bugging out because, you know, it's a thing. It's a big thing. People talk about it. They make it out like it's a do all end all be all. And it's really fun to talk about it with people who are uninitiated in the community. Yeah, I got a bug out bag in my truck. I got a truck gun and a bug out bag. And it's like, cool, man. But do you really know what you're going to do with that shit when the time comes? Have you thought about it? Like, have you actually thought about it and, like, I don't say war gamed it, but put yourself in your mind? Have you really put yourself through that and gone, okay, I know for sure this is how I want to react in the immediate moment. Here's the steps I need to take. Here's the information I need so I can evaluate it and make a well-informed decision. Because, you know, your area of operations where you live, right? If there's violence in your area, you want to get out of there immediately. That's going to be your number one objective, is getting yourself and your family, your loved ones, right, out of that immediate danger area. But how do you know if you're in that area or not? That's the question you have to solve for. So again, like we said, the radio, your chat, you know, local intelligence gathering and things like that. And then do you have the skills to support yourself after you've been able to make that assessment? And specifically, it's not just, hey, once I know, I'm going to drive to my bug out location at my parents' house two towns over and go hide out there, or I'm going to drive 4 hours, you know, here, and we call it up north, you know, just northern Michigan, right? I'm just going to drive up there, and I'm going to go hide in a cabin and I'm good to go because nobody's going to find me there for sure. I think a ton of people would have that idea for one, which is why one of many reasons why I don't always advocate for bugging out, at least not here in Michigan, because a bunch of people have property up north and it'd be the first thing so many people do. And when a bunch of people are doing it, you're not actually isolating yourself. You're just moving yourself to a less prepared position. But you start to see with this kind of cross-training concept of you discover that you, or I should say, you need to have cross-training so that you can support yourself with these multiple different skills. Because being a good shooter means nothing if it's the only thing that you can do. Because so many more situations, when we talk about overall preparedness, are beyond the flat range. So if you want to bug out to a family cabin in, you know, upstate New York, if you're in New York or northern Michigan or wherever, right? It could be south, you know, wherever you're going to go. Do you have the skills to get there? Specifically, if a cell tower goes down and you can't get Google Maps or Apple Maps on your phone, do you have a physical roadmap? And a lot of people will laugh, you know, because I'm sure some of you guys listening do have one because you were old enough to remember time in life when we didn't have, you know, smartphones. I'm old enough, I'm only 35, but I'm old enough to remember a time when we didn't have little like GPS units you could plug into cigarette lighters. And we didn't have smartphones with navigation built in. We had like roadmaps. And I remember you used to always be able to go to your local like AAA or State Farm office and they basically gave them out. That was like a big marketing thing for them, was that you could just go pick up a roadmap from your travel agent or your insurance office. And that's how you figured out where you were going for your family vacation. So for us, we used to head up to Traverse City every year. And I was always amazed as a kid. My dad just, he always knew where he was going. Everywhere. He always knew where he was going. I can think of like one time, maybe twice, two times in my entire life as a child where I saw my dad stop and pull out a map and figure shit out, because maybe it's just one of his gifts, is that he really just didn't get lost very often. Or he just knew how to read a map really well. I don't know. But I can only remember a couple times ever really being in that situation. And I can honestly say I don't ever remember my dad getting lost. And we went a lot of places. Like I'm not saying we didn't drive to like 30 out of 50 states or nothing, but in our state and everything, certainly. And he's not, even to this day, he is not the guy that puts shit into his phone and has his car tell him where to go. He figures out where it is and he finds his way there. It's actually really, really cool. It's something that I want to challenge myself to do more. Instead of being so dependent on Google Maps and Apple Maps, is that, or even, you know, find your way out there. And then if like you get a new job, right, build in multiple routes for yourself, find multiple ways to get to your work or get home from your work. Since more than likely you're going to be at work at 7 a.m, 8 a.m, shit's going to pop off due to whatever geopolitical incident, has incited the masses, right? Cause it changes basically every 6 months in this country. and then you're going to need to get home. And having multiple routes home is never a bad idea. So when things like the freeways are either, if it's a natural disaster and the freeway is flooded, you can find your way out on the surface roads. Or when they have mass protests because people are assholes on the freeway, then you can get off the freeway or avoid the freeway altogether, because you know this, because you've done your homework and, you know, done your reading and watched the news, whatever. You're going to use surface roads to get home. And when you encounter roadblocks there, you understand how to move around those, at least to some degree. I'm not saying you have to be a master of, you know, like the Rand McNally Atlas black belt, but like you're going to have some kind of idea of how to adapt and prepare yourself. And then you can audit that too. So, you know, maybe you do. Hey, you know, the first week of, or the first day of every new month, if you drive into work every day, some of us are remote workers, but if you drive into work every day, then hey, maybe the first Tuesday of every month, you take your alternate route to work, or your first week of every month is only alternate routes to get to work. And that way it's ingrained to your brain and you don't forget that stuff because it is so valuable. and then as you're doing this stuff, you have the opportunity as well to audit the supplies and things that make all of this possible. So if you do have a GPS or you do need that roadmap, make sure the roadmap's in your car. In addition to that, like if you have a go bag, if you have supplies or a toolbox you keep in your car, check that shit on a regular basis as part of your training. Is your flats, your replacement tire, your spare tire, is that still good to go? Because you have people that have vehicles for years and years and years. You drive a used vehicle and you've never touched the spare and it gets dry rotted. And then when you go to put that spare on, it does nothing for you and you're totally fucked. Things like that. Like that's part of you. That should be part of your evaluation process and part of your training. Certainly, I would say off the flat range and that's in pursuit of your overall preparedness and capability. And then, you know, you build this as a process and you could take it however you want, right? You can actually put this on your calendar. I mean, so many of us are task driven and task oriented in today's day and age. I know when I have stuff pop up, like I'm at the dentist and they're, hey, we need to come back in for a cavity filling or your 6 month cleaning, whatever. I get my phone out, I go straight into the calendar and I put it in the phone because that way it'll give me an alert and it'll go off and remind me. Or, you know, oh, hey, we have a family function that's coming up, a barbecue, because, you know, my aunt and uncle from Tennessee are coming into town, or it's so-and-so's, you know, like, landmark wedding anniversary or whatever. Everybody puts shit in their phones. It used to be like something that only the ultra rich and pretentious did with like their Blackberries and shit, is they'd get out their stylus and their stupid fucking, you know, Palm Pilot and then put it in their calendar and, oh, now I'll never forget. Now we all function that way. Because it's just convenient. Our alarm clocks are built into our cell phones. Our calendars are built into our cell phones. If we lose these fucking things, our life may certainly end as we know it. And that's not how you necessarily want to live. But all of this to say, you guys, let's bring it full circle. Just to recap. So evolve your mindset. Be more adaptive in your training. Don't be hyper. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't. Excuse me. You shouldn't pursue the things that you're passionate about. I'm not saying that you shouldn't pursue, you know, those things more heavily than others. For me, it's CQB, you know, and it's one of the great things is that in the last couple of years, it's become more and more acceptable to pursue a skill set like close quarters battle or structure clearance or whatever, to an extent, right? You know, small unit tactics on top of that. For years, right? We were told, hey, civilian, no. Bad. You can't learn how to do that because we said so. We've gotten rid of that stigma and, you know, it's a very, very good thing. And because of that, you know, I mean, I would have done it regardless, but it's easier for me to focus on that piece of training and it's not as invasive. And I have time and energy and resources left for all these other things that we just talked about. So going to the flat range, working on drawing from concealment or overt carry, right? On a duty belt, things like that. And then taking the time to plan those training outings in advance, and really be more adaptive with how I view myself and my self-development plan. Certainly, I don't think that in many instances, for my own personal survival, I would need to take shots with a carbine out to 200 yards. I live in a very, very urban area. Neighbors are very close together. I don't know that I would ever have the confidence, honestly, to take a 200 yard shot down my street or something, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that I should never subject myself to that kind of training. Additionally, right, we have streetlights all up and down the street and I own night vision. And that's not, we even get into night vision. You take white light difficulties in training and then you swap out white light for night vision. And that's a whole different beast. It's a whole different animal, which we have talked to many guests about that stuff. We can probably do a whole other discussion just on the challenges that exist working under night vision, right? Because you're limited by your illuminator, you're limited by your laser, your environmental demands, the power behind the unit, all that stuff, right? We didn't even get into that because I think in the scope of this discussion and talking about being adaptive, I think I wanted to be as all-encompassing and as general as I could with the scope here. I think night vision is unfortunately still something that a lot of people don't have access to, so maybe not the most helpful. But I mean, if you listen to this conversation and you see it for what it is, you certainly understand that the principle of what we're talking about here is just being more adaptive. So find ways to take those same skills that you're working on and building and then make sure that you're having a wider lens with how you view your overall evaluation and your own personal audit behind those things. So many of the things we talked about, right? So like white light, vehicle and disabled shooter, right? Or vehicle combatives and disabled shooter stuff. That stuff's huge, man. Because in reality, I think that's the most overlooked part of our training. And people will say they're capable. And then if you give them the what if you lose a hand, people then they become completely inefficient. If you have one functioning hand, you are still combat effective, to be clear. both with a rifle and with a handgun. But if you haven't trained on those things, or at least put yourself in the situation to have to try and work through some of those where you get shot in a hand, whether it's your support hand or your dominant hand, right? Now you can't reload that weapon with one hand because you never trained it. You don't know. You don't know how to clear a malfunction with one hand. You don't know how to manipulate that. So maybe if you get shot in the hand, you want to transition to just your handgun so that you're able to move, right? Because we talked a lot about movement and physical capability and physical health, right? Maybe you want to stow that rifle, right? Tighten down your sling, stow it behind your back, right? And then go to your handgun because you can move more easily that way now that you only have one functioning hand. And even the whole process of stowing a rifle with a, you know, on the sling. I went and to HTA, we did a CQB class, and went with my buddy Kyle. And Kyle found out firsthand, hey, that whole sling management thing is not a foregone conclusion, man. And this isn't throwing shade at him. He was not the only one that had struggles with it, but it's why you take classes and put yourself through this kind of training is because all of a sudden you don't realize that something like being able to swim through your sling and stow the rifle behind your back to be administrative with both hands, right? That's not an issue for you until all of a sudden it is. And then you realize you have that training environment realization that, hey, this is something I need to work into my dry fire. I need to know how to do this stuff because in real world, if I ever had to do a cover contact situation to detain somebody or apply medical aid or, you know, whatever the case may be, I want to be able to quickly and efficiently, you know, move this rifle into my administrative position, stow it behind me, without it getting caught up on my kit and things like that. And it was a good evaluation for his kit. He took some stuff off. He changed some stuff around. Like, and again, he wasn't the only one in class that had that issue. I'm just using it because he's a friend of mine. He trains with me on the regular and he's a good dude. He won't mind if I share this story. But that's the value of this kind of training and learning opportunities. And what I'm getting at with all this is if you never take the time, if you never invest the energy in yourself and the finances in yourself, right, to go on a trip, it doesn't have to be, you know, the Human Trafficking Awareness Range Day in Pennsylvania, which I'm pretty sure is September 27th and 28th at Ben Franklin Range this year. Shameless plug. Not so shameless because it goes towards human trafficking awareness, and I think that's a fantastic cause, but I digress. If you never took the time to invest in yourself, pay to go on that trip, pay to go to the event, and get just that limited bit of exposure to information and training from a good instructor, maybe you never realize that sling management and weapon manipulation is as important as it is and can be as difficult as you found it to be in that moment. But that's what we're talking about here. This is why having an adaptive mindset when you look at your training is important. It's not even, in some ways, it's not even just adaptive. It's just that you're never quite satisfied. You're always looking for the what comes next. Sorry, you guys can hear my voice again, ready to go. But you're never satisfied with where you're at, and you're always looking for that next thing because we talked about it with Garrett, right? With standards. Standards are very, very individual, right? So my standard of performance of, you know, let's say my draw and put around on target at 2 seconds is my standard. Hey, man, and if that's my standard because that's where I'm at proficiency-wise, cool. If I need to be able to meet that standard. But for somebody who's a great shooter, they should be able to do it in under a second if it's from a duty holster, right? So then is that if I'm only been shooting for a year and I'm just getting into the standards practice and things like that, do I need to hold myself to the same standards as somebody who's been shooting for 5 years doing this? Probably not. I mean, maybe, but probably not. I think that's where people kind of, the water gets quite muddy for a lot of people as they assume there is just one standard, and that is the one of the best shooter in their group. And if that's what you're doing that particular day on the range, then yes, by all means, you would be correct in that assumption, but it doesn't always have to be that way. So we can go on and on, you guys. I would encourage you all to, shoot me a message if you have questions on this, or maybe if you've had this realization of yourself that there's limitations that I just never thought about until something happened that I did. I'd love to hear that shit, man. That stuff is awesome. I think that the more we can push ourselves beyond our comfortable ability levels, the better off that we will all be. I'm not saying you need to like upend everything you've been doing and completely change, your training process, your training focus, right? Because I've said this before and I stand by it. I don't think that bugging out is a great concept. I think that too many people think that they're just gonna go run and hide in the woods like in Red Dawn. I don't think that that is the solution that a lot of people think it is. So I'm not saying you should go from what you're doing to spending all of your free time shitting in a hole in the woods and learning about camouflage. Maybe you just build that into what you're doing and become proficient with those skills as well. And understand, this is the most important part, mentally here, your processing, that we talk about processing a bunch, right? Because it is so important. But you have the added layer of understanding to know when you will apply that skill set and how it fits into your overall preparedness plan. Again, it's not just what you do on the flat range. It's like, it's not just going out on the weekends and, you know, setting up an observation post on an abandoned building and sitting there and camping out with your buddies and you know, doing a fake, you're an imitation observation post for your entire weekend while your wife sits at home wishing that you were doing something with the family. No, but find a productive way to build that in so you are more capable and more effective as an individual. So I hope you guys have taken some good stuff away from this. I think that the adaptive part of training is where you start to separate people who, you know, you have those buddies you start shooting with and some guys just, they start exceeding in different realms. I think it's because their mindset is more adaptive. They start looking for ways to be better and to change up their circumstances more rapidly than some of us that are okay being stagnant in our skill sets and stagnant in our, how can I say this? They're complacent in their performance and they're complacent in their ability. And here's the thing with complacency is it rots and festers, guys. So then if you're complacent with your skill set, eventually what you get is this like organic deterioration where you get slower and slower and less efficient over time by just telling yourself that like what you're doing is good enough. Like good enough is almost never good enough. And that's, I think, I mean, I don't want to like sit here and speak truth to the internet memes, but it, I mean, they're a meme for a reason. It's because there's a lot behind it. So I hope that all of this, everything that I was just able to like spit out here and you know, word vomit to you guys, this idea of building an adaptive mindset when we're looking at your training, taking it off the flat range, taking it to different and more interesting places for yourself in ways that you may not have ever done this before. I hope that this resonates with you guys and I hope you were able to take some stuff away from it. And if nothing else, I mean, A, feel free to, as always, feel free to reach out with questions, but hopefully it encourages you to reach out to somebody in your friend group or somebody locally or maybe somebody just online who's a subject expert in whatever you're trying to either expand into or maybe it's something you've been wanting to get into or currently are focusing on, but you don't know where to go next with it. And you see this person and they are a subject expert. And just, I mean, I don't know too many guys I've ever talked to on this podcast that are instructors or presences or personalities in the community that wouldn't be thrilled to get a message like, hey, man, I see that you do this a lot. I want to do more of that. I'm looking for a way to challenge myself. What can you help me with? I think most dudes would be super thrilled, completely tickled, right, with the opportunity to help somebody. Hey, man, challenge me. You're an expert, like you know, Viking Reconnaissance or Blake Water on Instagram, right? Hey, you guys are really into field crafting and you know, small unit tactics and reconnaissance and stuff like that. Here's what I work on, and I want to get better. I want to expand. I want to broaden my horizons. How can I challenge myself? How can I grow? How can I be better? Those dudes are going to give you some pretty good stuff to work on, or at least some good jumping off topics. Yeah, it might say, hey, you really need to take a class to learn how to do A, B, C, or D. and here's the thing. I will say this. I feel like I have to at this part of the conversation. If you reach out to somebody and their response is, well, we offer, their first thing on their mouth is, we offer this class, you can come and take it. I don't know that they're necessarily somebody you want to give your money to, because if their first priority is to make money and their second priority is to teach and enrich the community, they're probably not the best person to learn from, because you know their primary motivation is themselves and their wallet. And that's fine, because to an extent it's fine. It's not fine, but everybody has bills to pay. I'm not trying to hate on anybody for the grind. I'm not trying to, you know, hate on anybody for trying to make a living off of their hobby and their passion and sharing in a lot of instances, lessons that were learned in blood. I'm not trying to do that at all. But what I am saying is there's a lot of guys out there that in the pursuit of some of these things will try and take advantage of you. They are charlatans. They are less than genuine folks. And you need to be, as a well-read individual, at least be aware of that and be on the lookout for those kinds of poor and shady interactions. But there's a lot of good people out there with a lot of great, great information that are more than willing to help you guys. So thank you guys so much for hanging out. It's actually crazy. I'm sitting here looking as we're recording, looking down at the time and the timer behind this episode. And we're almost at like an hour and like, I don't know, hour and 20 minutes as I'm getting through this. It's crazy because these solo episodes sometimes can be a little bit difficult for me and problematic. If nothing else, it's because like my voice will be totally shot by the time I'm done with this. Like my throat is killing me and I feel bad. I don't like taking drinks in the middle of recording, because then it's like this odd dead space in the recording track, and at minimum then it gives me more work I have to go back and do the editing on. But this is, I think, been a really good one. I think we were on a roll there for a while. So hopefully you guys got some good tips out of this. Again, reach out and shoot me a message. Let me know if you guys are building new ideas and concepts, especially because we're close to the beginning of the year. So that whole new year, new me, New Year's resolution bullshit. Hey, I'm going to build this into my training. Maybe here's a positive one. Hey, I'm going to be more adaptive with my mindset and my training and my preparedness. I'd love to hear that shit from you guys. But thank you so much. So much for hanging out with us this week as we get through it, and look forward to the next couple weeks. We've got some really, really cool guests lined up. I'm very excited for it. I think you guys are really, really going to dig it. But that's all I got for this week's episode, folks. Thank you so much for hanging out with me and listening. Until next week, as the weather starts to warm up here, at least in Michigan, you guys be safe out there. And like we always say here, work hard, train smarter, and be prepared.